Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. We have Jimmy D. from Hatfield.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jim. I am an alcoholic. My home group is the Caring and Sharing group at the Lansdale Hospital in Lansdale, and I have a sponsor who I've had since I first got sober. He's worked the steps. I've worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I try to help others when I can, when I'm asked. So I'm going to try and tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I'm a little nervous. I wasn't expecting to speak tonight, so please forgive me. I grew up in Philly, about a block from the Tacony Bridge. Came from a family of seven, you know, Irish Catholic. Two older brothers, one younger brother, and three older sisters. My father was an alcoholic, and all my brothers were alcoholics, and I became an alcoholic. And none of my sisters got this disease. I don't know, you know, just it skipped them and all the boys did. I remember my first drink, and I remember my last drink. My first drink, not counting like sips of beer when I would get my dad his quarter Ballantine or something like that, but my first drunk, I was about 12 years old. You know, we lived in row houses in the city, and we were playing a game called Tin Can Alley, where you hide out and throw the can or whatever when you came in. And I remember I hid out in the garage, and my older brother's crowd were in there. They were like 18. And they were feeding me all their shorts. And I think they had, they called Ollie in for like eight times, and I never went in because I was sitting in the garage drinking them shorts. And I remember having to take a dog for a walk after that and just being wasted, not even knowing I felt good. I'm like, this is cool. This really feels good. And I liked it from the get-go, you know. And the next time I got drunk, I was a couple years older. And I had a pint of whiskey, and sat in an old jalopy that my brother had in the garage, and drank the pint of whiskey with another guy. And I remember wanting to go down the park. We went down the park, and I wanted to go over to beat up all the nuns in the convent because I hated nuns. And the last thing I remember is being thrown in my door and waking up the next morning in my underwear, wet, like just drenched, because apparently my brother and father threw me in the shower, clothes and all, and I was still toasty, you know, the next morning. And I guess I didn't get in too much trouble that time because it was the first time, but they, I got grounded for a week or something like that. But, you know, the drinking continued through high school. I drank like everyone else on the weekends, and except I was the one that didn't go home, you know, after, like, we would be drinking on the corner, and everyone else would go home at 12 or 1 o'clock, and I was the one guy, I would stay there. If there was any beer left, I was not going home. And most of the guys I hung with, they were drinkers too. And we didn't get into heavy, into drugs or anything. And there was a crowd around the corner that was a little worse than us. And they would come around once in a while looking for a fight. And nobody ever bothered me because my one older brother was kind of crazy. He was a neighborhood bully, I guess you could say, and nobody messed with you. They were afraid of him retaliating if they hurt me or whatever. And that kind of sucked because I got drunk and I would go looking for fights because I was, you know, the peewee, the little guy, had that little guy syndrome. And I remember Jersey, you know, being 18 in Jersey. We were drinking over in Jersey in bars at 16 with the paper draft cards. I remember the first time I walked into Roger Wilco. It was like Disneyland. I mean, you open it, the doors open up automatically, and all you see is all this colorful booze, you know. And I'm 16 years old. I'm sweating. I'm thinking, these guys aren't going to serve me, you know. And I get a case of beer, and the guy served me. I was like, wow, I got served. And, you know, we would run across the bridge all the time to get beer. We drank in a bar over in Riverton called the White Eagle Tavern. I remember that place. And it was a bunch of young kids in there drinking, and it was crazy. But, you know, that's We got away with it then. And I had all my beer muscles at an early age. I realized, you know, I got beat up a lot from the time I was like 16 to 21 or whatever. And once I realized I wasn't going to be 6 foot tall, I learned to be a nicer drunk. You know, I was like, I got my ass kicked too much. I needed to get nicer. So I became more of a happy drunk and less of the antagonistic guy, you know. I remember we lived right near the railroad tracks, and a lot of times the kids would open up the boxcars to see what was in them. And they would get Air Force jackets or briefcase. And one year, everybody's father in the neighborhood got a briefcase for Christmas. Even if he was a construction worker, he got a briefcase, you know. And then the one time we opened it up, and the boxcar was full with Budweiser from the top to the bottom. And there was an old abandoned army camp right next to the city park there. And we unloaded hundreds of cases of beer into this army camp. And the other gang around the corner that were not, you know, they were a little rougher than us. They had a deal with McDonald's. McDonald's would give them ice, and they would let McDonald's keep their windows. So that was a good deal for McDonald's. So we got all the ice we needed, and we iced down all this beer, and everybody got toasted that night. And the next day, the cops from the 15th walked through the army camp, almost in an arm-in-arm thing, and just loaded all that beer into their cop cars and took it. And that was the end of it. You know, we never saw it again. And the boxcar moved, of course. There was another time we got peppermint brandy and schnapps, peppermint brandy and blackberry schnapps. I think that's what it was. It does not go good mixed, you know. And a bunch of 16-year-old kids drinking that, most of us wound up throwing up, you know. So I never had the urge to have peppermint schnapps again after that. I remember hanging on the corner. And my older brother, my one older brother that was the crazy one, he was about 22. He came out from the bar across the street. I was about 16, and he was stumbling across the street, and he came out, and he pulled a gun, and all the guys took off, and he put the gun in my stomach. And he told me if he ever caught me doing drugs, he would shoot me. And he was wasted on meth at the time. I thought, you know, if that's what it does to you, I guess, I don't know. I was scared because he was goofy. But I tell you what, it took away the urge to do drugs. I never really got in. I mean, I smoked pot, but I never got into the drugs. Beer was my drug of choice, alcohol. And whiskey was bad for me. Whiskey was like fire water for me. I got nasty when I drank whiskey. Anyway, I met a girl in high school. We dated through high school. She wanted to get married, and I wanted to go in the Army. I remember going down to catch a trolley car to go get the physical to go in the Army. And I said, you know what? I don't want to go in the Army. I went home, and we got married. And I should have went in the Army. Yeah. It's not good getting married at 19 when you're an alcoholic. You know? So the thing that came out of that marriage was her father got me a job at I worked a couple odd jobs out of high school, and then her father got me a job at Smith's Brewery. And we'd get 2 half-hour beer breaks on an 8-hour shift. And you were allowed to drink, you know, while you were working. So I remember, you know how Bill talks about he had arrived when he says it in his story. He had arrived when he's got the apartment in Manhattan, the expense account, the fair weather friends. Well, when I was 19, I felt I had arrived. Because they asked me to work overtime, and they put me in this place called the government cellar, and all I had to do was watch the guy switch the vats over from one beer to another, so when they were pumping it up to the filler, they could change whatever labels they were using. So I said, well, how come I have to watch him? He said, well, there was a brewer that had a heart attack, and nobody found him to the next shift, so the union says all you have to do is watch him when he changes things over. Well, I said, what do I do the rest of the time? And the guy says, come here, kid. He shows me on the vats, there's little pickhocks. He said, you can have dark beer, light beer, regular, whatever. He takes me over to a desk, and there's a big wooden desk there. He pulls the desk drawer open. There's a big ashtray on the desk. He pulls the desk drawer open, and there's a stack of Playboys. Now, I'm 19 years old. I'm a Teamster. I'm getting time and a half to drink and read Playboys. I had arrived. This was a career. I wasn't going anywhere, you know. This was the best job anyone could ever imagine for an alcoholic. And the guys that I wanted to hang out with were the guys that had like 30 years there, because they were the guys with the big red noses, and they knew how to drink. And I wanted to drink like them because they were the professionals. And I remember going to a bar with them and hanging out with them. And I remember falling off a bar stool down in a bar front in Girard. And the one old guy looks at the other guy and says, "You know, we're going to help him up." He said, "No, he got down there on his own. He can get up on his own." They were not nice guys, and I wanted to hang with them, you know. And I remember one bar we went to, and I knew the bartender from my neighborhood, and I told him, "Look, you have to cut me off at 5 o'clock because I got to go home with my paycheck. You got to cut me off. Don't let me have another drink." You know, he cashed my check at the bar when I got there. 5 o'clock came, and he tried to cut me off, and all I wanted to do was, you know, get into a fight with him. "No, you can't cut me off. I got money. I'm paying." He said, "No, you told me to do this. You're done. You're not getting." I said, "You got to take my money." And so I'm sitting there arguing with this guy for 30 minutes that he couldn't cut me off after I asked him to cut me off. Again, I was 19, and I remember my wife at the time telling me, "You know, you're an alcoholic." And I said, "I'm not an alcoholic, because you can't be an alcoholic if you just drink beer. I'm staying away from the whiskey." I believed that statement at that time, that I couldn't be an alcoholic because I was drinking beer. Well, I got laid off a number of times. I worked there until I was about 22. I kept getting laid off, going back, laid off, go back. I went into the reserves, the Air Force Reserves, and when I came back from my 6 months of active duty, that wife that married me at 19 decided to leave because she knew what was good for her, and we had a son, and she left. For the next year, I drank my face off by my, you know, being, catching up for what I thought I missed while being hooked up with her in high school and all. And I went to all these beer blasts, the Monday night special at the townhouse, $7 all you could drink, the Thursday night special at the AD club, and $7 roast beef and all you could drink till 11. All these specials. And I was collecting unemployment. I was living it, you know, I was enjoying it. Even I started to recognize that I couldn't go to sleep without a six-pack. I couldn't fall asleep at night without a six-pack in me. And it got to the point where I knew I thought, you know, maybe I am drinking a little too much. Maybe it's time to get out of Dodge. So I went and looked at going in the service full-time, and I switched over to the Navy. And I went in the Navy full-time thinking I'll drink less. I just learned to drink in different places, you know. I met another girl right before I left, and the first thing I told her was, "Don't ever say anything about my drinking, because my first wife did, and you see where she's at, you know." I was such an ass, you know. She left me, and I'm telling this to the new girl, you know. So she was young, and she liked to party, and that was, you know, she played quarters. She got along with the drinking part, and I thought, all right, that's all right, And I was away in the Navy anyway. I would come home and leave and see her, come home and leave. Then I got stationed close by, and I was coming home every weekend. And we got a little more serious. And then I remember I reported to my first boat, and it was a submarine. And there was 150 guys on the crew, and we were in a shipyard. And out of 100, they did a random urinalysis, and out of 150 guys, they popped 80 as coming up positive with drug use. So they took 80 guys and just threw them out of the submarine service. Because it was the Reagan years, and they were not tolerating it. And so 80 out of 150, yeah, just say no. Another reason to stay away. I didn't want to ruin what I had going in the Navy. So, again, I just stayed. Drinking wasn't frowned upon like AA. Like the drugs were. I remember the first time I went to see you. I was baking at night. I was a cook and I was baking at nighttime. And a couple of guys came to me and said, "Duff, can we get some yeast and some sugar?" I said, "Yeah." and some grape juice. I said, yeah. And what else? raisins, anything you can give us, you know. So I knew what they were doing. They were making some homemade wine. And they had this big plastic bottle that they made it in. They got a glove from the dock, and they vented it every day for like 10 or 12 days. And a couple of weeks later, down the pike, the one guy came to me. I was sleeping, and he said, hey, we're testing our hooch. Do you want to try some? I said, I'll wait till we're going to have it on halfway night and celebrate. And then a second guy came and said, hey, we're testing the hooch. I thought, you guys aren't testing it. You're drinking it, you know. I know. So I went ahead and went to where they had it stored. And this is where they had it stored was in what they call the fire control center. And it was a keypad entry. And this is basically where the button is to fire the nukes. So that's where they're all drinking. They had it stored in the outboard of the computers there. And there's about eight guys in there, and they're drinking this stuff. And it tastes like yeast. That's what it really tastes. It tastes. We put raisins in it, but it tasted like grape yeast because it had the Welch's grape. But it did the job. I mean, it messed a couple of guys up pretty bad. And then a couple other guys decided to steal the officers' toilet seats off their heads. On these old submarines, you couldn't go to the bathroom without a toilet seat because you would fall down into the toilet. So they were not happy when they woke up and couldn't go to the bathroom. And the captain, a couple other guys didn't show up for watch, and the captain knew something was up. So he lined everybody up he thought was involved in front of the corpsman's office and made us take urinalysis. But they found the recipe in the radium's locker, and they were relieved that it wasn't drugs, so they just slapped our hand and said, don't do that again, you know. Which was good because, you know, we didn't get in trouble. You know, I managed to do another 4 years in there without getting in any major trouble. And meanwhile, I got married to the girl I started seeing while I was in there 3 years. And she moved down away with me down to Charleston. And we had a baby, had our first baby. And every time I would come in from port, in from sea, we would have keg weekends and beer baseball games. I mean, it was all about drinking every time we were in port. And she kind of, once we had the first baby, she kind of tapered off. She didn't drink as much anymore. And I thought there was something wrong with her. And, we got through another couple of years, and I got out of the service and came back to Philly. And at this point, my younger brother was living on the street due to drugs and alcohol. My older brother was really bad. He was having pancreas attacks. My dad had been in the hospital a number of times with alcoholic atrophy and nicotine poisoning. I mean, he was not in the best of health. And the other brother was just still crazy. And I started joining the shuffleboard league, the dart league, pool league, whatever league I could join to be at the bar and not home. Because that was my kind of drink. I didn't drink at home. I drank at the bar. I liked the bar scene. I liked going to the bar. I liked hanging out in the bar. And I would go back down even in my old neighborhood and drink in the same bar my dad drank in, you know. And it was cheap, you know, 25-cent Pilsners or whatever. We bought a house up in Oxford Circle. And there were two bars right around the corner and an after-hours club right on Castor Avenue. So that was even more enterprising. And then I got a job. I remember I got a job in Trenton, and I was working at it's now called the College of New Jersey, but Trenton State University. And everybody I worked with was single, so they went out to drink after work every day. So I was going out with them and then getting behind the wheel of a car and driving home to Philly at 11, 12 o'clock at night and going to the after-hours club. And then coming out of the after-hours club and, you know, going home. And I remember one night, my wife waiting for me on my birthday. I said, I'll be home. It was my birthday. She waited for me, and I never made it home till 6 in the morning. And she locked the door. She locked all the doors, and she put the chain on the front door. Well, I managed to get the door unlocked, but the chain was still there. And I remember just being so pissed off that she locked me out of my house and kicking the door till the whole frame of the door came out. And I took the frame up in our bedroom and I threw it on the bed and said, don't ever lock me out of my house. And she was crying. She was upset. She waited, you know, for my birthday. And she'd never waited for me on my birthday again after that. And, you know, I was the one that had to fix it. I can't tell you how many times I had to fix things around the house. You know, things that I broke in a drunken rage or a drunken stupor or whatever. You know, walls and door frames and windows. And I remember having a fight with my ex-wife and had my son in my one arm and punched a window out with the other. And, you know, I was the one that got cut, but I could have hurt the baby. So many, you know, the things that you do, you don't even think about when you're drinking. It takes your morals away. You know, it takes your soul. It takes part of your soul. Anyway, we started arguing on a regular basis about my drinking, and she said if I didn't get help, that she was going to take the kids and leave. And I did. I left and went with my brother for a little bit, like a week, and then we made up and went back. Finally, she asked me, you know, you got to do this. You got to quit. If you don't quit, you know, we're not going to stay. So I remember I remember thinking about that one day at a time thing that I've heard about AA. I didn't really know a lot about AA, but I knew that they did the one day at a time. So I said, I can do it one day at a time. So one day at a time, I quit. Didn't drink for 2 weeks. We went out for a family dinner with her family. And her brothers all ordered a beer, and I ordered a beer. She said, what are you doing? I said, I ordered a beer. Why? I said, because I quit for 2 weeks. Now I can drink. You know? She said, what do you mean you quit? I said, I proved to you I could do it. I quit for 2 weeks. It's okay now. It's all right. It'll be okay. You know, I'm telling her, don't worry about it. I had already quit. Now I know I can do it. 2 weeks. 2 whole weeks. I had mastered it. So within 2 weeks of that, we were fighting again. And I remember sitting in my dining room table eating a meatball sandwich, coming in after the bars closed. And I was eating a meatball sandwich, and she's talking about leaving. And I said, you don't have to leave, because as soon as I'm done this meatball sandwich, I'm going to take this steak knife and kill myself. And she said, why are you waiting until you're done your sandwich? I said, the sandwich is too good. I didn't want to stop eating it, you know. Anyway, I passed out before I even finished the sandwich. After that incident, we talked about she wanted me to go to this couples retreat, couples escape weekend it was called. And I thought it was like a marriage encounter thing. It was at a Catholic retreat house in Blackwood, New Jersey. And she said, you know, if you go to this with me, you know, I would appreciate it. Maybe we can talk about what's going on and work things out. So I wanted to keep the peace. And usually, you know, after I did something bad, if I did something good, I could buy a few weeks of goodness and then maybe be able to drink again. That was the pattern. So I said, yeah, sure, I'll go. And we get over there, and her girlfriend who lives around the corner that she grew up with, and her husband are going, and her husband was in AA. And we get over there, and I find out it's an AA Al-Anon retreat. So I'm like, oh, I'm throwing the suitcases back in the trunk. She's like, please don't do this. Please don't embarrass. Please can't you just stay? I didn't know it was an AA Al-Anon retreat. Till this day, she still says she didn't know that. I don't know whether she did or didn't. We decided to stay, and she said, you don't have to do anything. You don't have to participate in anything. Just listen. So I said, all right. So we go in and unpack, and we go sit down at dinner, and we sit down at this table with this guy, Walt, who is a friend of her girlfriend that she grew up with, a guy named Bobby D, and Blind Franny from Delaware County. I don't know if any of you know him. So we sit down, and Bobby says, watch this, Jim, and Franny's got to go to the bathroom, and Bobby takes him to the bathroom and leads him into the wall. And he thinks it's funny, you know, and Franny's cussing him out. And he takes him into the hallway, and he puts him in the ladies' room, you know. Franny is just taking this, he's just tormented. So the whole weekend, he's tormenting Franny, and Franny comes back from the bathroom, and he starts telling me jokes. I don't know. I just met the guy, and he's telling me, Jim, I got kicked out of Sears the other day with my C&I dog. I said, why? He said, well, I had him on a leash, and I was swinging him around. And I'm like, why? He said, I was just looking around, you know. And Franny's going on, and he's like, he's introducing me to his wife, Madeline. Now, Madeline's blind, too, and he says, this is my wife, Madeline. I don't know what she sees in me. We met on a blind date, you know. And if you ever heard Franny talk, you know that this is the way he is. He's constant like this. And I'm like, this guy's crazy. The next day we get up and we're doing, first that night we had a mass, and Bobby D put itching powder up on the priest's high chair. So the priest is up there where they're doing the readings, and he's itching all over the place because he just sprinkled it all over the back of the priest's chair. The next day we go in, do Stations of the Cross, and Walt is cheering for Jesus to get up. He's, come on, Jesus, I know you can get up. These guys aren't talking about sobriety or alcohol to me. They're just having fun. They're laughing. They're joking. They're really goofy guys, you know, and they're having a blast. So I go through the weekend and I listened a little bit to the retreat leader, the priest, and who was a recovering alcoholic. And by this time, the alcohol in my family was definitely taking its toll. All my brothers were bad. In fact, I remember talking to my oldest brother. He just had a pancreatic bypass. He'd had a year in the program. He was a Philly fireman. And my youngest brother was on the street again. And I said, I remember stopping at his apartment telling him, you know, you guys need AA. You should go to the meetings. And I'm telling him that. I said, I didn't think I needed it because I had a family and I paid bills and I was surviving. I didn't lose anything at that point. So at the end of that weekend, Walt came up to me and he said, hey, a couple of guys are getting together in the chapel. Do you want to join us? I said, sure. He didn't tell me we're having a meeting or, you know, we're going to talk about alcohol. He just said, guys are getting together in the chapel and you want to join us? I said, sure. So I go in the chapel and what they're talking about is what it means to be an alcoholic. It was exactly what I needed to hear because I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know if I was an alcoholic and I wanted to, that's the question I had. And I said to Walt, how do you know if you're an alcoholic? He said, I don't know, Jimmy. So all I can tell you is if alcohol is causing a problem in your life, then you probably have a problem with alcohol. And I had that moment of clarity in that chapel, the moment of sanity, whatever you want to call it. And I asked Walt if he would take me to a meeting. And he agreed. And that was February 15th, 1988. By the grace of God and through this fellowship and the many, many people who, in AA who've helped me, I haven't had a drink since. But there were a lot of rough roads in between. I got sober and I started going to Castor Gardens with Walt. He held my hand for about 6 months, took me to Castor Gardens, took me down to South Philly where he was from, took me to the Stepping Stones, St. Tim's on Levick Street, and then on my own I started going to St. Martin's on Sunday nights, and you know, I just started going around at different meetings, and I started to learn a little bit. It took me a couple of weeks before I actually raised my hand and said, my name is Jim and I'm an alcoholic. I mean, for 2 weeks I couldn't even say it. And then when I said it, Walt said, oh, now you're the vice president of AA. Castor Gardens was a good beginning for me. I got involved in that group for a little bit. Then I moved around, and a few years in, I had a cousin that was sober, and he and a few friends started a meeting at a Tacone group down in at St. Leo's, and they started a Joe and Charlie session there. And by this time too, my oldest brother that was fireman, he after I got about a year, he got the funny one thing was that. We had a meeting about doing a family intervention on my younger brother because he was off the street living with my parents again, but he had just stolen their VCR or something. And so we had a family meeting about doing an intervention on him, and my older brother came at my house. And 2 days later, he called me in work and said, Jim, I just checked in the living room. So the intervention worked. It worked on the wrong brother, but it worked, you know. So you never know what God's going to do, you know. Eventually, my younger brother did get in the program, too. But the first 5 years, I really, really hung on to the fellowship. I got really involved. I did a lot of activity, played ball, got involved with hanging out with other AAs all the time. We would go watch fights together, go fishing, just do lots of different things together. And it was okay for a while. The first few years, I started to grow a little bit, but I kind of did a half-ass. God bless you. I did a half, as they say, half measures avail us nothing. Well, I did a half-ass attempt at the steps. I did them, but I didn't do a great job of them. And by the end of 5 years, I was as loony as I was when I came in, and I was angry. I had a lot of anger. I used to ask my sponsor, "How do you deal with the anger?" And his answer was, "How does a violinist get to Carnegie Hall? You know, practice, practice, practice." Whenever I called my sponsor, he always asked me first, "Did you pray on it?" And if I didn't pray on it, he tells me to pray on it. And then I call him back. He said, "Did you look it up in the big book?" And then if I didn't look it up in the big book, I have to. So at first I have to pray and look at the book, and then I can call him. That's his rule. Well, it was a good rule because I learned a lot by looking in the book. And then I remember my wife at 5 years sober pounding me on the chest, calling me an SOB alcoholic. And I'm thinking, I'm 5 years sober. Why am I an SOB? What's wrong with me, you know? So this guy that was running the Joe and Charlie meeting, Fishtown Charlie, and another guy named Larry, a chef, they kept asking me to come to Joe and Charlie, come to Joe and Charlie, come to Joe and Charlie. I said, I don't want to listen to tapes to get sober. I need to hear how other people are living sober. And I just had a closed mind. You know, they talk about, you know, the only thing that will keep a man in everlasting ignorance is contempt prior to investigation. Well, I had that contempt. I didn't want to listen to tapes. I thought I needed to hear people. Eventually, I went, and the first week was good. The second week was a little bit better. By the third week, I was hooked, man. Here I was 5 years sober, and nobody ever told me those three concepts you get out of the first 164 pages. What's the problem? What's the solution? And here's the outline for the practical program that you need to recover from alcoholism. Is that a secret? Why aren't people sharing this more, you know? I've been coming around to meetings for 5 years and I never heard that. Why isn't this being talked about everywhere? The problem, man, I knew I had a problem, but I didn't understand. If a mechanic gets a car that's broken down, he knows the car's broken down, but he's got to understand the problem before he can fix it. That made sense to me, you know. That made sense. I have to understand what my problem is before I can fix it. And then the book outlines what the solution is. The solution's that spiritual awakening they talk about that you get as a result of working the steps. I didn't have any spirituality in my life. And I started to do these steps, and it was amazing. Now, I did have a spiritual experience at 4 years sober, but it wasn't an awakening. I like to think that I got the awakening, they talk of the educational variety back in the Appendix 2, that slowly happens over time. And I always say this at our meetings when we talk about it is, for me, a spiritual awakening is like when you wake up in the morning and you open your eyes and you begin to look around the room and become aware of where you are and what you're doing. You slowly become aware. You become awake. Well, that's what it's been like for me in this program. It's slowly I've become aware of living a spiritual way of life by practicing the steps, by doing the steps and practicing them and trying to help other alcoholics. I didn't do that on my own. People showed me how to do that. People held my hand. At 4 years sober, I was 34 years old, and I had a heart attack. And I didn't think I was having a heart attack. I thought I was having heartburn, you know, because I was too young to have a heart attack. But and my wife was teasing me. She said she wanted to, I called out of work, and I never called out of work. She said, I was upstairs getting a shower, and she wanted to use the car because we only had one car at the time. And she says, she called up. She said, "Are you done having your heart attack yet?" Because I didn't want her to use the car. And she came up the steps and saw me on the floor having a heart attack. So she regrets saying that. I was. And I wound up going into Frankfurt, and they They sent me down to Jefferson to do angioplasty, but at the time it was still relatively new, and stents were brand new. It was early 91. And they want to put a stent in my heart, and because I'm young and the stent was too big and my arteries are soft, they ripped the artery during the process, and I had to go in for emergency surgery. So I come out of the surgery, I get better, I go home, and now my kids are little. I have four kids, and my daughter, who was about 8 or 9 at the time, asked if we can hold hands and say a prayer. And I said, yeah, absolutely. So we held hands around a table, and she thanks God for family and friends and for having her daddy home. And there was nobody behind me, but I felt a hand on my shoulder. And I felt a peace and a presence that I cannot explain to this day. I just recently shared this with someone who told me, I said, I didn't have any fear. And they said, you didn't have any fear? I said, no, I had no fear because I knew everything was going to be all right. I felt like an overwhelming sense of, you know, just everything was going to be all right. She said, having no fear is a glimpse of heaven. I thought, wow, I never thought of that. And I told a priest one time about it, and he said, you're very lucky. He said, people go their whole lives without feeling a presence like that. And he said, you may never feel it again, but he said that was a blessing. And I do look at it. I never felt it again, and I would love to, but I never have. But I really, truly believe that that was a spiritual experience for me. I had one other time that I did early in sobriety. My wife was pregnant with our fourth child, and I said, oh, man, four kids. How are we going to handle four? And she woke up early one Saturday morning and said, Jim, we need to go to the hospital. I think I lost a baby. So we rushed to the hospital. All the way there, I'm praying, please, God, I'm sorry I questioned you. You know, I do want this baby. I don't want to lose, you know. We get to the hospital, and the doctor took her in the back room, and they wouldn't let me in. And he came out, and he said, well, Mr. Duffy, your wife lost a fetus, but she still has a fetus. So he was a twin. And when he was about 3 years old, we were in my bedroom, and he was leaning on the floor like this, telling me about his brother who had one wing. Because he, and they say little kids are closer to, you know, I believe in spiritual things today because of just a few of these things that happened to me. You know, I got into the Joe and Charlie. I redid the steps. I was 8 years sober before I made amends to my ex-wife. And because I was holding on to a resentment about that. I signed adoption papers when I was in the Navy for our son. And it wasn't until a guy who'd done the steps the right way took me through it and pointed out to me in the fifth step, when I told him, oh, she was a witch, she was horrible, she did this, she did that. And he said to me, so tell me how much of a prince you were in that marriage. He made me look at my side of the street, you know, and the light bulb went on. I realized all she was trying to do was protect her son. And I was able to let go of that resentment and forgive and be willing to ask for her forgiveness. And I made that amends, and man, what a weight off my shoulders. This program really works the way it's supposed to, you know. So I, about 9 years sober, my younger brother got sober. He had 2 years clean and sober. And I had an opportunity to go down to West Virginia for my job. And I wanted to get out of Oxford Circle. That was definitely part of it. And so I went down and looked at the possibility of moving to West Virginia. And when I came back, it was early fall of 96. And just that summer, my younger brother had come to my office and asked me if I would be his best man in his wedding. And he went from having nothing, from being on the street, to having a house, a car, a job, a fiance, all, you know, 2 years clean and sober. It all came. Well, she left him, and he picked up one night. He picked up a drink first. And after he picked up the drink, he decided to go down to Kensington Avenue, and he picked up a girl, and he picked up heroin. On Friday, they found him and the girl in the Hub Motel dead. He was only 34 years old. So he didn't pick up for 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years. He picked up for one night, and he died. after having 2 years in this program. That was devastating, not only to me, but my kids. He was their favorite uncle. When I had my heart attack, he came to the house and told my wife, you go to the hospital and be with Jim. I'll take care of the kids. He fed them. He did homework with them. He took them out. You know, he did everything with them. He was a good soul, but he had this disease. And he didn't make it. So eventually I moved down to West Virginia. One of the great things about moving and when you're in AA is you can find AA anywhere. And initially, as soon as I got plugged in AA down there, I found a host of new friends and some great friends down there. And I got involved in AA down there. I did GSR work. Later became a DCM. Now, the thing about down there is you don't have the... Up here, we're lucky. We have so many meetings to choose from. Down there, you have to drive for a meeting. You might have to drive 25 miles to get to a meeting. And within a district, there were only like 15 meetings. So we had our district and a neighboring district had another... I think they had 18 meetings. But I got to drive, you know, all over the state going to assemblies, going to the convention. And I did that for a couple of years. And I remember the meetings... The first time I got involved in the district meetings, man, we would argue. Now, if you're not, some people are good for service, other people are not. We got into some nasty arguments, but the one thing we did after every district meeting, we all went to the Chinese buffet and laughed afterwards, you know? So that was a blessing. I learned a little bit about the inner workings of AA and how to give back a little bit in the service. And it helped me a lot. It helped me grow. And when my time was up, they talk about the spirit of rotation. When my time was up, I moved on. I had to let go. My hard part was, and this was another lesson for me, I knew that the person they were going to put in as DCM would not make it. And I wanted to tell them, you can't vote that person in. Don't do it. You know? But I had to keep my ego in check, and I had to pray. And I talked to my sponsor. I stayed connected with my sponsor up here. I had a sponsor down there while I was down there. But anyway, the person that they elected in the DCM position lasted about 2 months. So I couldn't even say I told you so because I didn't tell them. So because I listened to my sponsor and kept my mouth shut. But I made a lot of friends down there. And through the years, I had another heart attack and another more health issues. Even I had in 05 they put a defibrillator in, and I was teasing. That was the year the Eagles went to the Super Bowl. I said, "Can you set it to shock every time the Patriots score?" Yeah. And I wanted to make sure my wife didn't get a remote to it. You know. One of the things I like to tell too is that I was about 47. I guess I was about 18 years sober, 17 years sober. I never got a tattoo when I was in the Navy. Never got a tattoo because tattoos were, you know, $70, $80. That was drinking money. I was not going to pay money on a tattoo when I could drink in a base club for that, you know, whole weekend with $70. So when I got sober, my wife and I went away one St. Patrick's Day weekend. I think I was 47. And she said, "Let's get a tattoo." And I said, "Really?" And she said, "Yeah." So I said, "All right." So I got her name on my leg with a little clover, and she got my name on her lower back there. So the next time we saw my sponsor, she said, "Hey, Walt, look, Jim's on crack." That was her, she said. So she got her sense of humor back after living with me for all those years. Through the end of the years in West Virginia, my son, we have four kids, two older daughters and two younger boys. They're all in their 20s now. My son, through high school, my one son got this disease like me. And he drank and he got in trouble and he smoked pot and he got in trouble. And finally, he had an old Honda that they had shared with the kids, and I took the Honda away from him. I grounded him, took the Honda away from him, finally made him go to AA meetings with me when he was 17. And he went to AA meetings with me. He finished his senior year. He seemed to be good, and he went in the Navy. And about 18 months of the Navy, he wound up getting kicked out for drugs and alcohol. And he was came home with his tail between his legs, and he said, "I need help. I need help. Can you help me, Dad?" I said, we'll get you in the right place." I wanted him to go to rehab while he was in there, but he didn't want to do it. He wanted to come home because he was over in Japan, and he just was homesick. So he came home and got involved in the meetings and started going with me and picked his own young friends. And a friend of mine in the program, his son hired him for a job that required traveling all around the country. And so he got a good job. He was doing millwork type of stuff. And it was a really good job. And he got he was making meetings in California, Alabama, Texas, Wilkesboro was one place he was for a while. And he got about 11 months sober. And my wife's mother had gotten cancer, so we decided to move back up here. And I had more stents put in, so I wound up out on disability, and my job wasn't holding me there anymore, so we decided to move back up to Pennsylvania. And my wife got a job in Lansdale, so we moved to Hatfield about 07, I guess it was. Oh, yeah, 07. And my son had 11 months sober. He had a sponsor in Wilkesboro who he was doing the steps with him. And in the fall of 08, when the Phillies were in the playoffs, in the World Series, he was down in West Virginia in the town we used to live in doing a job down there. And he hooked up with some old high school buddies, and he picked up a drink first. And he just turned 21 that August, and it was October, so he never had a legal drink, even though he was in the program. And he went and watched the Phillies in the playoffs, and once he picked up that drink, drink led to something else, you know, and somebody gave him some Oxycontin, and he died. He was just 21. That was the first time in a long, long time I wanted to drink. I didn't think about it the week he died or the week we buried him. I mean, I had a lot of friends. AA surrounded me with love and support, and I had a lot of great people come and help me out. And when I wanted to drink, it was about 2 weeks later. And I thought, you know, I could drink and my wife wouldn't leave me. That was my first thought. She wouldn't leave. She would understand. And other people would too. Nobody would hate me. Nobody would hate me if I picked up a drink. I could do this and kill the pain. And the instant the thought came to my head, the phone rang, and it was one of the guys from my home group. And he said, "Do you need to make a meeting?" And I said, "Yeah, I do." And another guy called right after him. I said, "Yeah, Jimmy's coming to pick me up right now." And the other guy came, and we went over to Hilltown, and I shared about it, and it passed. And the thought passed. And I thank God. I got on my knees that night, and I thank God for letting it pass and for the people that came. It was like I had banked this help somewhere along the line, and when I needed it, it came out, you know. And the one guy that came that night, he asked me to take him through the Big Book. So I did. I started to take him through the Big Book, and a second guy asked if he could join. I said, "Yeah." So the second guy joined, and then it turned into six or seven guys going through the Big Book. And they liked it so much, they said, "Can we do it again?" And we did it again. And it was about nine people. And we were doing it in a back room in Souderton. And then I said, "You know, this is really hard. Why don't we just do a Joe and Charlie meeting? It's similar. It's very much the same thing, you know." So we went to the Montgomeryville group, and who were having a step meeting on Tuesdays that were getting like two people. And we said, "Would you guys consider changing the format to Joe and Charlie?" And they said, "Yeah, if you guys want to, we'll try it." So we tried it, and it's been going on 2 years now on Tuesdays. And it's 19 weeks long, so I can get a plug in for this meeting. We start again on December 6th at week one. The neat thing is finding people to chair it, too, for the 19 weeks, because the people that chair it get a blessing, too, because they're going there. They have to listen really intently for the 19 weeks because they have to share and summarize, you know. But it's a great way to open up the big book to people, and it's a great way to share. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate AA, how much AA is. I would not be alive were it not for AA, because I wouldn't have taken care of myself. I wouldn't have gone to the hospital at the times I needed to go to the hospital. I wouldn't have quit smoking. I wouldn't, you know, I probably wouldn't have made it past my early 40s if I had not come in these rooms. And I believe God gave me this program as a gift. And it's a gift that I don't want to give back, because my life is so much better. Today, my wife and I will be married 30 years next September. She stayed with me. We have three kids still, and I have two beautiful grandchildren that I get to see. I take my grandson to kindergarten on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and he's a cool little kid. I really enjoy being around him. And this is the easier, softer way. I always say that. This is the easier, softer way. There's a guy at Cedars, he says, and I'll say this because I need to plug the book as much as I can. In them first 164 pages is the program of AA. You know, this guy Steve, he shares, I'm stealing it from him, as we all do. Nothing is original except my story. But he said, imagine coming home from work and finding a letter in your mailbox from Bill Wilson and taking that letter and throwing it on the counter when you get in the door and not opening it. That's what you're doing if you're not opening the big book. You know, he wrote that personal history in that big book to tell us how to get sober. It says it right in the book. So if you haven't got into the book, if you hadn't got a sponsor who hasn't helped you get into the book and find that higher power we need to recover, I suggest, you know, try it. You got nothing to lose. We got our whole lives to keep doing this over and over and over. And it just gets better. It really does. So I thank Dave for asking me, and I thank you guys for listening to me. Thank you.